And it was a miserable, miserable day.
You guys ready?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Scott Ward.
And I'm Don Freeman. And today we have Dr. Tim Noakes with us, athlete, medical doctor, researcher, professor, and author, Dr. Noakes. He is well known for challenging common and old paradigms in the discipline of exercise physiology. As an athlete, he's run over 70 marathons and ultramarathons, which includes Comrades Marathon, a 54-miler across the African desert. He knows a thing or two about running, Scott.
He does.
Dr. Noakes has written The Lore of Running, and if there's a running book that should be in your library, it should be The Lore of Running.
I think it's on its fourth edition now, is that right?
I'm not sure.
Yes, that's correct.
I think
if
it's fourth
you're
edition.
Speaking to me, that's good.
He tackles the physiology and biomechanics in that book and answers just about anything that you need to know about running, but today specifically, we're going to tackle his latest book called Waterlogged. And he is, in fact, busting some of the myths, as Scott said earlier, as we were talking earlier, about the dogma and myths around drinking water.
And the interesting thing, and Dr. Noakes, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but this isn't something, you know, you just came up with last year and decided to write a book. I mean, you've been working on this since the early 2000s, correct?
Well, in fact, since 1981. I mean, that was the sort of the key moment was in 1981 when we discovered the first lady who'd overdrunk during an ultramarathon in South Africa. And that set me on a course. But it took 30 years to complete all the evidence and write the book. So, yes, certainly. Writing the book, I probably started in about 2003, 2004. And it certainly took about 8 years to finish it off. But the work really started 30 years before.
You know, out on the trail, and this is the mantra that trail runners are given and passed on from mentors, and I'm guilty of the same thing. Is we've always said, drink early, drink often, and you will ensure yourself a good race. You won't cramp. You won't have any problems if you can get enough fluid with you. That answers any situation that you might come across. And now reading your book, I don't even know if I should carry a water bottle. So let's put some of this in perspective, Dr. Noakes. Help us out here.
Yes, you know, it's a long, sad story. And unfortunately, what happened was industry influenced what happened. I know people will now say I'm a conspiracy theorist and so on, but the reality is industry lives there to sell a product. And when I started running in 1968, 69, there were no such things as sports drinks. There were no such things as supplements. There were no gurus, nothing. And literally, when you went to a marathon, you were examined before the race, and you were fed off at the start, and it was your responsibility to get to the finish. If you wanted to take fluids, well, you better find someone to give you fluids. If you wanted to eat, which we would never have thought, even considered doing, you had to find someone to provide you with that. And if you didn't get to the finish, it was your fault. It was... The race people were completely unconcerned about your health. That was your responsibility. Then what happened after 1976 was that more and more people started running. And all of a sudden, race organizers realized that they actually had to provide some sort of medical tents, a medical facility, to look after the collapses. And I was one of the first doctors in South Africa to be involved in the medical tents. And literally, I would run the marathon and finish and then go trundle over to the area, and you might see two or three people with blisters or a headache or something, and that was it. But after 1976, things really changed as more and more people started running, and what happened, I think, was that people were not as well trained. A large group of population weren't as well trained, and all of a sudden, there were now hundreds of people collapsing at the finish and needing medical care. And one of the mantras that came up then was, because now the sports drink industry was suddenly starting, was that these people collapsed because they hadn't drunk enough. And that was completely wrong, although personally knew it was wrong, because when people didn't drink, they didn't collapse. Now they're drinking more, and more people are collapsing, so the two didn't seem to fit. And so we started doing research and discovered that actually the problem is you must have a control group when you do research. So if you look at a person who collapses after the mountain, that's all very well, but you have to prove that that person is more dehydrated than somebody else who finishes a race without collapsing. And we could never show that. We always show that the people who get into trouble in marathons are no more dehydrated than those who win the race. And in fact, the winner is usually the most dehydrated athlete in the race and also the hottest. So the one who should be really suffering is the one who wins. So that was kind of the information that we had. And at the same time, after 1981, we started noticing that more and more people were finishing these races with low blood sodium concentrations, and they were really sick. They were often unconscious, and they sometimes had respiratory arrest, so stopped breathing. And we knew if you didn't treat them properly, they were going to die. And with time, in 1988, we studied a group of them. We studied eight of these runners, and we showed, without exception, all of them had drunk too much fluid, and they'd retained the fluid, and had got what we call water intoxication. And we published that work in 1991. And we proved, beyond doubt, that the real cause of problems in marathon running and ultra-marathon running was in people who overdrink, who have a slight biological abnormality and they retain the fluid, their brains swell, and as a consequence, they're in real trouble. And if you don't treat them very carefully, you will kill them. And we published that work in 1991, and we assumed that's the end of the story. We've shown if you drink too much during a marathon or an ultra-marathon, you're at risk of dying if you get this water intoxication problem. And I remember the editor of Runner's World, Andy Burford, was in Cape Town in 1993, and in a month before, the first death from this condition had occurred in a race in California, the Valley of the Giants Marathon. And I told Andy, I said, Andy, we've got a problem. Unless we do something, there's going to be a whole bunch of deaths in American runners. And I said, it's going to be the female runners who are going to be at risk because they're the ones who are told to overdrink and they run slowly and they're going to get this condition. And my prediction happened absolutely predictably, that that's what happened. Now, while we were sitting in Cape Town and South Africa were saying, don't overdrink, the industry was driving the scientists in the United States to provide evidence that we were wrong and that dehydration was the real killer, that you wouldn't perform well if you didn't drink as much as you possibly could. And we knew that that advice is going to cause problems. And unfortunately, the scientists won and the industry won. And the guidelines for drinking that came out in 1996 said, during races, you must drink as much as possible, or sorry, as much as tolerable, I must use the right words, as much as tolerable, or your performance will suffer. And we knew that was an invitation for disaster, and that's precisely what happened. So the end of it all is that we know there have now been 14 deaths from this condition, not just in the United States and not just in runners. There's some in triathletes and also in hikers, desert hikers, and particularly in the military. And there have been well in excess of 2,000 people hospitalized with this condition, so seriously ill that they had to be hospitalized to save their lives. And it's a condition that's completely unnecessary. It's completely iatrogenic. In other words, it was doctor-induced, or it was induced by the advice we gave to runners.
Now, Dr. Noakes, may I ask you if we're consuming a product with an electrolyte balance of some kind that promises electrolytes in, does that make us immune to this condition? Is this strictly water-based fluid, or any fluid really is going to put us in jeopardy? Because this is pretty important for us to understand.
Yeah, that's a really great question, because the industry tried to say that because there's a homeopathic amount of salt in sports drinks, and you got the message, I said it's homeopathic, that it's going to prevent. And the answer is it's not. And the reason is, when you overdrink, if your body's normal, you will simply excrete the excess. And that is why most people don't overdrink during exercise, because they learn that they just pass so much urine that they might as well not drink as much, because they're wasting their time. The problem with this condition is that you secrete a hormone, antidiuretic hormone, abnormally. And when you shouldn't be excreting it, you are excreting it. and that holds on to water. So people who get a water get water intoxication, they overdrink and they excrete an excess of this hormone. That causes the kidney to retain the water. So whilst they're running, they're not passing urine, so they assume that they're dehydrated, but they aren't. They're retaining the water, and that's the problem. Now, what that hormone does is it hangs on to the water, but it gets rid of the sodium. And in fact, that's how we make the diagnosis in these patients, is we find their urine's got lots of sodium in it, but there's no sodium in their blood, or the sodium is low. So it doesn't matter. The only drink you can drink to prevent this condition is seawater. And no one's going to drink seawater because you will get sick. And the treatment for the condition is we give you seawater in your veins, a very concentrated salt solution. And that rapidly can cure the condition. But no one can drink seawater during exercise because it's so concentrated you'll just vomit it up. So the answer is, no, there is no drink that you can drink during exercise which has enough sodium in it to prevent the condition.
Okay, interesting. Now, you're talking, and much of the research is coming from the marathon distance, the 26.2 miles. What about these folks that are running, you know, 50K and 100K and 100-mile events? They're out there much longer, and do you find that there's a higher prevalence of this condition or risk for the longer distances?
Yes. Absolutely, because you have to be much more accurate with your fluid consumption if you're going to go more than 4 hours. So the problem normally arises in marathon runners who drink about 40 ounces an hour for 4 or 5 hours. We're talking about women who are only sweating at a rate of 20 ounces per hour, and they're drinking at 40 ounces per hour. So every hour that they run, they accumulate 20 ounces. And after 4 hours, that's enough to make you go unconscious. Now, when you run an ultra marathon, you actually run a lot slower so that your sweat rate is lower. So therefore, your fluid requirement actually goes down, not up. So every hour, you actually have to be more cautious to get it right. Because if you're a little over for 10 or 15 hours, you're going to get the problem that you get the same problem that you would get in 4 hours if you overdrank a lot every hour. So the risk, yes, is much increased in ultramarathon races. And I think that is true. We know that the Hawaiian Ironman triathlon has the highest incidence of this condition of any race in history. There were something like, as I recall, about 800 cases of hyponatremia. Not all hospitalized, but serious cases over the 15 years that we studied. And that's an enormous amount. And it's because the race advice given was you must drink as much as you can because then you'll run your race faster.
So, Doctor, what are the first signs that we should look at? We're monitoring ourselves out there and we're going to be running for a while. What are some indications that we're finding ourselves with too much fluid?
I think the first thing you notice is you might notice that your stomach starts, you start hearing gurgling in your intestine. And that's because there's so much fluid in the intestine that hasn't been absorbed. And so you will feel that you've got all this fluid in your intestine. The next thing that you'll notice is probably your pace comes off. You can't maintain your pace. And then you'll start vomiting fresh water or clear water. As soon as you vomit clear water, you know that you're overdrinking. The next sign is you start to become confused, and within a few minutes you will go unconscious and could have an epileptic seizure. So those are the keys. Your performance goes down, you feel that you've got a lot of fluid in your gut, you vomit, and then you feel confused, and then you'll go unconscious. And what happened was people said this is the signs of dehydration. Absolutely not. You do not become confused and lose consciousness until you've been out in the desert for 3 days and not drunk. 3 or 4 hours of marathon running can never make you sufficiently dehydrated to be at risk of ill health. Particularly in an environment where there is so much fluid available. There's no other place on this planet where there's more fluid available than running a marathon in a big city in the United States.
True, you're right. True. So we may be confusing some of these dehydration symptoms and or overhydration, excuse me. We're confusing overhydration and labeling it as dehydration and then just trying to choke down more fluid, which is the opposite.
Causing more problems.
Yeah, spiral in a worse effect.
But that's correct. So you get worse and you feel worse. And I've treated numerous patients who said, I became confused and I knew that's because I'm dehydrated, so I knew I had to drink more fluids.
And just to
and
exit.
That's the problem. And can I just, a very, very important point that I make in Waterlogged, and you know, I research your literature completely, as you can see. And incidentally, Waterlogged is only 60% of what I wrote. I wrote another 40%, but the publisher said, no, we can't publish all of that.
Right.
And they sifted out the 60% they felt was the most important. They said, you made your case. You don't have to overkill. But the point I make is that we are designed to drink to thirst. That's the key. All animals, creatures on this earth are designed to drink to thirst. Those are the biological controls. The fact that we have a conscious brain doesn't make us any different from any of the other animals when it comes to the basic controls of eating and drinking. We must drink to thirst and we must eat to hunger and we'll be fine. So if you're running and you're not thirsty, you are not dehydrated. That's the key. And you don't need to drink.
You know,
so the only sign that or symptom of dehydration is thirst. So when I see a collapsed athlete, I say, are you thirsty? And he or she says no, then I know they're not dehydrated and I'm not going to treat them for dehydration.
Wow. You know, that raises, I'm going to ask a silly question here.
Sure.
What is thirst? What does that feel like? Is it just cotton mouth? Is it, you know, I'm trying to think the last time I felt thirsty. I mean, I have a little bit of a cotton mouth right now, but I don't know whether I would classify that as being thirsty.
That's right. You're quite right, because we now drink ahead of thirst all day. And to really understand thirst, what you have to do is what you did as a child when you went out and played and exercised for hours on end without fluid. And then you get this intense desire to drink fluids. And your desire completely focuses on where's that fluid. And you won't want to do anything but find fluid. And so, of course, you get a dry mouth, but that's kind of quite a late sign. So the first thing you'll do is you'll seek out water or fluids. You'll want to know, I need fluids now. That's the first sign of real thirst. And the best way is for athletes to run without drinking. You know, when you mentioned I've run the Comrade Marathon a few times. The first few we ran, we weren't given fluids for the first 30 kilometers, or sorry, 20 miles. There was no fluid on the course. You just didn't drink for 20 miles.
Wow.
And after 20 miles, you wanted to drink by then. But we were so conditioned, we didn't really drink very much anyway. But to go 20 miles without drinking was just, that was the standard. You knew that was right. And you didn't overdrink and think that you developed a heavy thirst at all.
So you mentioned some of the signs of this exercise-induced hyponatremia, where you get to the point where you need medical treatment. Are there other signs like weight gain, or you know, we call sausage fingers, where your fingers start to swell? And if that's the case, I mean, here's what I have been told is if I start having my wedding ring starts feeling tight or my watch starts feeling tight and I know that I'm retaining water, my solution for that to this point was I'm not getting enough electrolytes in my system. So I'll pop a couple, you know, salt tabs and think that that's going to cure my body and start helping that water get absorbed into my system. And I'm assuming that's incorrect.
That is, you're quite right. You're absolutely right. But that's a sign that you're seriously overhydrated once your ring finger starts to swell. Or if you have a race number at one of these bracelets, they get tight. And I remember I've seen, that's what we often use. We ask people, is your wedding ring tighter or your race number tighter. And they will tell you that that's the case. And so that is a very good sign. And you're quite right, you get sausage fingers. But that is, I mean, that's quite advanced. You know, you probably put on 2 or 3 or 4 kilograms by then. So it's a real sign that you're in trouble. Now, the point I would make is that if you've retained so much water, it's not just because you're over-drinking, but it's because you're secreting this hormone, antidiuretic hormone. Now, we've treated patients in the past who've been unconscious for 4 days.
Wow.
Now, they've been unconscious for 4 days because they continue to secrete this hormone, antidiuretic hormone, in excess, and they don't switch off its production. And only will they get better. Sorry, there is a newer way of treating, but in the old days, the way we treated patients, they will only get better when they stop secreting the hormone, and then they start to pass lots of urine, and they recover as soon as they start to pass that urine. And you can give them sodium, unless it's in very high concentration, it's not going to make any difference. And again, it has to be in very high concentrations. So the point I'm making is that this condition, in which you find yourself running a race, getting swelling fingers, you're secreting antidiuretic hormone. The only thing that will correct it is I either stop drinking, but biologically within you, the only thing that will cure it is for your brain to stop secreting antidiuretic hormone. As long as you're secreting antidiuretic hormone, you can't reverse that by continuing to drink anything. It's just going to make it worse.
And I assume that, you know, that's something that's not voluntary. You can't say, okay, stop producing this hormone. Is there something that we can do or something we can take that will help that happen?
Stop drinking.
Well, he said stop drinking, okay. But that's only part of it. Your body is producing this hormone. Somehow you need to tell your body, or your body needs to quit producing this hormone. Does that happen by just saying, okay, you need to stop and sit down and relax and get your heart rate down? Is that the best thing to do, or what is the best solution?
You're quite right. That probably helps. Of course, the point is, if you do stop running, if you do stop drinking at that point, you're not going to get sicker. You're just going to eventually get rid of that food excess, but you mustn't drink. You must just stop drinking for the next hour or two until your fingers have got thin again and you're feeling better. But very few people will do that because they don't have the courage to believe you can run for 2 hours without drinking. So that would be the key. You should actually just stop drinking and only drink again if you feel that you're thirsty. But you're quite right, even if you stopped, in some people they can stop and they will retain that fluid because they've secreted too much hormone for many, many hours afterwards. And as I've indicated, in some people it takes 3 days before they turn off the abnormal secretion of that hormone. Now, what we would do today is, let's say you did come in and you had swollen fingers and you were semi-conscious, we would give you a very, very high concentrated sodium of about 3%. What that does is that extracts water out of the body because the sodium gets into the kidney and it extracts the water. Even if the antidiuretic hormone is acting, it doesn't matter. High sodium will get the fluid out. And in 8 hours, we can completely correct the condition, provided we give you enough of this very high concentrated sodium. And that is a treatment now. So even if you are unconscious, we would expect you to be normal again within 8 hours of proper medical care.
But I want to make sure that this is very clear. If you are in that situation, you're in the middle of a race, by just taking 5 sodium capsules or here in the United States, we like to take hard-boiled potatoes and dip them in water and then dip them in table salt or sea salt and ingest that. That's not nearly close to the amount of sodium that you would need to equal the treatment that you're talking about.
That's correct. We have to drive. We push the sodium into the veins, and that it just drags out the water from your kidneys. It has to have a very big dose coming in towards the kidney. And you can't do it by taking it orally because it'll be diluted anyway in your intestine and so on. So the amount of sodium that actually gets in is at such a low concentration, it's meaningless.
Okay. So I'm going to try to dumb this down for me to apologize. let's say that we're out for a 4-hour training run, and we know that it's a hot day, and we're sweating a lot. And what you're saying, the best thing to do is just don't drink anything until you start feeling thirsty. And when you do drink something, just drink water, nothing else.
That's correct. You can certainly drink sodium as well, but it really makes no difference whatsoever. The requirement you have is purely for water. There may be a small requirement for carbohydrate. If you're always training on carbohydrates, you probably will need some carbohydrate. But if you're adapted to burning a lot of fat, you really don't need carbohydrate. But the one thing you can't get away with is you have to have water. That's correct.
Okay.
And that should be enough to get you through.
So is it important to know what our sweat rate is? Does that play any, is that a factor in any of this? Or do we just say, you know, it's not really even important to know what your sweat rate is, whether you're a little overweight or you're working harder or paces, it's hot outside. You don't need to know what that is. Just drink to your thirst.
That's correct. And the problem is the information that the U.S. has been given, U.S. runners have been given, comes from scientists who are absolutely committed to the belief that if you lose more than 2% of your body weight, your performance is impaired. And it is true that in the laboratory, if you have a fixed work rate, in other words, if I put someone on a fixed work rate so that they have to keep pedaling or running at the same speed until they stop, you do tend to do worse if you're 2% dehydrated. But that is not how humans exercise. When we exercise in marathon races, we pace ourselves. And all the data show that when humans pace themselves, the only way to maximize your performance is to drink to thirst. And that means that in some people, they'll finish a marathon with 10% body weight loss, as happened to Haile Gebrselassie when he set the world record in Berlin. He lost 10% of his body weight. He speeded up at the finish, and he set the world record, what was then the world record. Now, had we said, gee, Haile, you've got to drink so that you don't lose more than 2% of your body weight, he wouldn't have finished the race anywhere near as fast. That's what the evidence shows. On the other hand, there may well be the second or third runner who, when he does go more than 2% dehydrated, he gets very thirsty. And to get 4 or 5% dehydrated, he will be extremely thirsty and his performance will be impaired. So we believe that the evidence shows that it's thirst that impairs your performance, not weight loss. So if you run and are thirsty, your performance will be impaired. But as long as you run and are not thirsty, it absolutely does not matter what your sweat rate was, what your fluid intake rate was, how much weight you lost. They're unimportant.
So
as long as you avoid thirst.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
As long as you avoid thirst, your performance will be maximized.
Okay. And I'm going to answer my own question here. This isn't just a redundant question. These big races that are longer, like the 100K, 100-mile races or 24-hour races where they have medical checkpoints, where they have scales, where you're required to step on the scale. And if you've lost a certain percent of your body weight and they say, you know what, you can't go on, you need to stay here and drink, that's completely erroneous.
It is completely erroneous. And in fact, there is a scientific study showing that the people who lost the most weight were more likely to finish. And that's exactly what I would have predicted. Because in my view, the best athletes are genetically or whatever, or they train themselves to do better on drinking less and carrying less weight with them. And that's we've always found that. The very best runners are the ones who can sustain a huge weight loss and not be affected by it. And even in the literature, as I discuss in Waterlog, that's precisely what's been found. The best runners always lose the most weight. And we can understand it in evolutionary terms that humans evolved as runners, and the guys who would do best would be the ones who didn't need to drink when they were hunting antelope. We didn't need to stop and worry about fluids. They'd be the most successful ones. So biologically, it makes all fantastic sense that we are designed to actually run and become quite severely dehydrated and still to be able to maintain our performance.
You mentioned in the book, and if anybody hasn't paused now and gone out and just purchased Waterlog, that's what we'll wait for you, and we'll be back. Because that book is just full of, if you want to hear more of what Dr. Noakes is talking about with some great diagrams and you want to get into it and get the details, well, it's all there. And I would say, yes, that is a mandatory on your reading list. Even more important than the race directions. Even more important than
the map.
The map for the race. You need to go read Waterlogged and find out what's going on. You mentioned in there that the body has an amazing ability to correct itself and correct for conditions. And you talk about catastrophe theory versus the body's amazing ability to adapt to whatever it's thrown at it. And it can regulate sodium very well and has resources to do so. And even with fluid, providing that you know you're not in such extreme conditions, that we need to respect that and respect our body and have confidence that, yes, we were built for this. And yes, in fact, we do not have to impose our will upon this already great system.
I think that's a very good summary. We wouldn't be around if we didn't have this incredible ability to regulate everything very tightly. And it turns out that humans were designed to run, and we were designed to run in the desert heat. And so we've got everything there to control us to be successful. And unfortunately, we lost it because the scientists got involved in this catastrophe theory that you had to do what they told you. And only if you did what they told you would you survive the races. And I guess that we had to justify as scientists what we're doing and make ourselves self-important. But I just remember what Roger Bannister said years ago. He said, the human body is centuries in advance of the exercise physiologist. And that's the reality.
Oh, that's a great line.
Yeah, and here was the guy who broke the 4-minute mile the first time. By understanding his physiology, tests a little bit better than other people. But that is the reality. The human body is so complex, and the controls are so exquisite that we can't even begin to understand how to achieve it.
You know, let's talk about some of the things that we already listen to our body about and have become, I think, very good at it, at least if you're going to survive any long distance, and that is pace. You know, we don't subscribe to run as fast as you can and as hard as you can, and I hope you make it, but that's what we do with drinking. Drink as much as you can and as often as you can, and we hope you make it. So pace is something we've learned to listen to our body about. Breathing rate, if we started to say breathe as fast as you can and as hard as you can throughout the race, that would certainly be a recipe for disaster too. So there are so many things that we already listen to our body about, and we need to turn that same attention from those subjects to drinking. Would that be a good way to look at it?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, if I can emphasize that the control of all these biological parameters that you spoke about reside in the archaic parts of our brains, the parts of our brains that we share with all other creatures. And what happened is in the last million years or so, we suddenly got this big cerebral cortex which we can do our thinking in. But that's got absolutely nothing to do with the control of these basic biological functions. And you can't think these functions. You can't work out how much you must eat or how much you must drink or how fast you can run. That's being done by the brain in the most exquisite way. You know, the question I remember when I started running and wanted to run the Comrade Marathon, the 54-mile race you spoke about, and I met some of these guys who ran it, and I met a winner in the race. And I wondered, how does this guy know to run 54 miles? So the final mile that he runs is the same pace that he ran the first mile, because that was the ideal performance, or the first of 2 miles, and that he didn't slow down, and that he wasn't so exhausted that the 54th mile was a disaster. And it struck me. I just said, how can that possibly be? Because in training, you never run 54 miles. So however do you learn to run the right pace? And then I began to understand the exquisite nature of the controls in the body.
Can we talk a little bit about urination along the course of the day? And let's go to the longer events. You know, you're out there for 6+ hours or 12 and beyond. What would you expect to be usual and regular and appropriate for fluid intake, and we're talking about a fairly hot day, you know, 70 degrees Fahrenheit plus. Mm. So you're out there enduring those conditions. Should we be urinating frequently, and what color should it look like? And that's about nine questions.
And does the color mean anything?
And that's 10. So go ahead, doctor.
Yeah. The answer is that, you know, probably if you don't urinate, that's fine. And that was my experience in all these years. If you don't drink very much and you do become 10% dehydrated, you will have a high antidiuretic hormone, but it'll be appropriate and you won't pass much urine. And I must tell you that we have done numerous studies on kidney function, and the kidneys function perfectly normally. The fact that you're not passing urine doesn't matter. It doesn't mean that the kidneys aren't being perfused. In other words, they're getting a good blood supply. They aren't functioning normally. The point is that the antidiuretic hormone is so high that instead of excreting the urine, they simply reabsorb it. But they are functioning normally. So the fact that you're not passing urine doesn't mean to say your kidneys are not functioning appropriately. And the reality is that to affect kidney function, you really have to run very fast. The speed at which you run, even a marathon, doesn't affect your kidney function. It doesn't reduce the function at all. So if you're not passing urine, it's simply because you are losing more fluid than you are gaining, and you are having high ADH secretion, and you're just retaining and not passing urine. So, you know, I certainly, in the marathon runners that I've watched, if you're running a hard 100K race, I wouldn't expect you to pass urine in that 100K race, particularly if it was running the heat, and that would be perfectly normal. And you ask a good question, what about the color of urine? Well, if it's dark, that just tells you you're secreting a lot of antidiuretic hormone. It doesn't tell you what your fluid balance is. The way to measure your fluid balance is just to weigh yourself. And if you've lost 5 kilograms, or what, that's about 10 pounds or 11 pounds, well, that's what's normal for you. And you will regain that fluid within the next 10 hours or so. By the time you go to bed at night, your weight will probably be pretty close to normal again, because the regulation is so good, it will have reversed that weight loss.
So
my point is that the only measure of your level of dehydration is not your urine color, it's your weight loss. And I would make another point that when you run a marathon or an ultra marathon, you probably lose about 5 pounds of water that you don't need to replace immediately, and also carbohydrate stored in the muscles. So 5 pounds is what we'd expect you to lose and be retaining your normal fluid status. You mustn't think that because you've lost a pound, you've lost a pound of water. That's not true. You may have lost some of the carbohydrate in your muscles, and you may have lost some of the water stored with it. And many of us believe that you have about 4 pounds of water excess in the body, that we're overhydrated. Humans are normally overhydrated. And that water sits in the intestine. So as you run and you become so-called dehydrated, you start to extract that fluid from the gut and to use it for other cellular functions. So your body fluid status is fine, even though you might have lost 3 or 4 pounds.
So you mentioned something in there that I want to expand on. You said that normally we probably overhydrate during the day. Now I've been told since I was a little boy, you know, adults should be drinking 8 glasses of water a day. Should we prescribe to the same water intake idea here, where just going through the day, we shouldn't be drinking anything unless we're thirsty?
That's a great question. And the answer is, if you do drink a thirst, at the end of the day, your weight will be the same. Your fluid balance will be identical. What that 8 glasses was meant to mean, that you will generally drink about 2 liters of fluid a day. And I'm just thinking, if that's 40 or 50 ounces, it's probably about 60 ounces a day. I'm not quite sure of the number. The point is that's actually the amount of fluid you need to ingest, but it's not just water. It could be tea or coffee or other drinks. And that's where they made the error. So people said, I must drink my tea and my coffee and my other drinks, and as well, I must drink 8 glasses of water. That wasn't what was meant. It was meant that you must drink equivalent amount of fluid as would be found in 8 glasses of fluid, not water. So a general, if you're not running, your general fluid balance is about 2.5 liters a day. And if you're drinking that, you'll be in perfect balance. On the other hand, drinking a little bit of extra water of 2.5, even if you had lots of coffee and tea and you drank another 2.5 liters of water, it would not make any difference to your health because it's such a little volume, your body will easily excrete it. But drink that 2.5 liters over 2 hours and drink another 2.5 liters over the next 2 hours and you can be in serious trouble.
So within that daily consumption of liquid, I have been told that, you know, here in the United States, we are overindulgers in many aspects, but one of them is with sodas, soda pop. And I've heard that those are very, very bad because they're very high in sodium. I would assume, and I'm making an assumption here, that in those, that quantity of liquid that you were talking about, you cannot, soda is not one of those because it doesn't do the same thing.
Thank you for picking up, and that's why I didn't say soda, because soda is liquid candy. That's the reality, is it is just so full of carbohydrates, particularly high fructose corn syrup or sugar. And there's so much good evidence that that is what's driving obesity and diabetes. Not just directly, but because it drives you to look for other sweet drinks and sweet foods as well. And so you really, your health is very important that you do not drink any sodas at all. And that's Dr. Robert Lustig from California is driving that story. And it's a very, very important health message that if you want to drink, you should drink water, tea, and coffee, and maybe a few other alcoholic drinks. But that's about it. You shouldn't ever touch a soda drink because it's just full of sugar and high fructose corn syrup, which is absolutely unhealthy.
Well, that's what I was waiting for. You just pushed me over the edge. I would never, ever take, I liked your liquid candy comment, because I would never take a large glass, 32 ounces, and fill it up with a Snickers bar and gumdrops and then ingest that. I just wouldn't do that. So why would I do that with a soda?
Well, and we also know that diet drinks, now they're not full of the high fructose corn syrup or
sugar,
but
poison.
We also know that they're just as bad. Can you expound on diet sodas?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point because they're even more toxic, it seems. And I think what happens is that, so my whole theory about eating is that you've got to be very cautious about how much carbohydrate you take. And that conflicts absolutely with what I wrote in Law of Running. And I've come up and said, guys, I apologize for saying high carbohydrate diets are ideal for everyone. If you're carbohydrate intolerant or what we call insulin resistant, as I am, we can't metabolize carbohydrate normally, and over 20 or 30 years, all it does is it drives you to become fatter and ultimately develop diabetes. And the only cure for us, if we're carbohydrate intolerant, is to get rid of the sweet taste, because most of the foods that we eat, the processed foods, are highly addictive, and the component that's addictive is the sugar, plus the salt, but predominantly the sugar. And the more sugar we eat, the more addicted we become, the more carbohydrate we eat, the fatter we become, and the sicker we become. Now, replacing the high fructose corn syrup or the sugar with a sweetener, all it does is it delays your desire for those sweet things, and you will find those sweet things somewhere else. And I think that's why these things don't work. Ultimately, our cure for us who are carbohydrate intolerant and addicted to carbohydrates is we have to get rid of the sweet taste, this addiction to look for sweet foods. And you can't do it if you're forever searching for sweeteners. And you have to cut the sweeteners and you have to cut the desire to eat and drink sweet drinks. It took me 14 months to get off the sugar addiction because sugar is so profoundly addictive. And now I do not take sugar in anything and I don't eat any sugary anything. I've not had a sweet for 2.5 years. I've not had a soda drink for at least 2.5 years. Not even a sweet sports drink or a sweet juice or anything like that. Haven't had a dessert. Haven't had a chocolate for 2.5 years. And the point is I can now sustain it because I know I've got rid of the addiction. But if I reintroduce those sweeteners and the sugar, I will be starting to look for those foods again, and I'll get fat again, and I'll get diabetic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the view, my view, about sweeteners. They don't work because they don't cure the problem. And it's like giving an alcoholic one drink a day. It doesn't work. They will get up to their 10, 20 alcoholic drinks a day very quickly. You've got to cut the sweeteners as well.
You talked earlier and alluded to kind of on the carbohydrate and water topic, so I'll see if I can blend this. You had said if you train yourself to be a carbohydrate runner and your body, then I'm assuming instead of looking towards its fat stores, is really looking for that next goo or that syrup that you're going to pour down so that it can keep going. That's how you've trained it. You've conditioned it to use that fuel. Can we learn to become more efficient with our fluids?
That's a great question. I think you can partially, but it's kind of the rest of the day. You tend to sweat less, or in some way you conserve water. So in other words, if you do restrict your water intake, within a few weeks, your body does become more efficient in its metabolism of water. Whether that happens during exercise, I don't know. I think that generally the way you drink and also the way you eat during races is how you conduct the rest of your lives as well. So if you're a reluctant drinker when you're not running, you'll also be a reluctant drinker when you're running. If you are a high carbohydrate eater during your normal day, you will also be a high carbohydrate eater during exercise. So I think that genetically that's the main driver of how much you drink during exercise. And I was fortunate, always a reluctant drinker, and so I drank relatively little during races, even though I might have at some stage told people to drink a lot. In fact, when I looked at my own data, I never drank very much during exercise and finished all my races pretty dehydrated. And that was the way I prefer to do it. But I'm also a reluctant drinker during the day. So I think that the point, I think it's a genetic driver, and you're either a reluctant drinker, or in some people they drink a lot, they need to drink a lot, and during races they will also need to drink a lot, and they probably can't really change that very much.
Now for those of us that have decided, well, I'm not going to overhydrate, and I'm not going to go out there and see just how much I can drink in 50 miles, what do you recommend? Do we go cold turkey, or should we do a gradual change here in our drinking habit?
That's a great question, which I've never been asked before, because I always just tell people to drink to thirst, and I can understand. But what I would suggest is that people start doing in their training, they start, go run for an hour and don't drink and see what happens. And you'll find that actually you can easily run for an hour without drinking, and then run for 2 hours and don't drink. And then you'll see you don't need to drink at all, or very little during 2 hours. And you'll start to get thirsty after an hour and a half or so. And that will teach you that you really don't need to drink within the first 5 minutes of starting a marathon. And maybe that's the best way to do it, and say, okay, let's get to the first station. Well, I know in training I didn't need to drink here, so let's leave that one and move to the second one. Okay, in the second station, maybe it's 5 miles. Okay, maybe I can have a drink now. Maybe I'll have my next drink at 10 miles. And that's the way I would do it. So I wouldn't go completely cold turkey, but I would first try in training to see that actually you can go a long way without drinking very much. And then say, well, if I can do it in training, I can certainly do it in races. And so gradually wean yourself from not drinking every seconding station. That would be the key. I honestly think that you only need to drink a little bit every 3 miles, and that's, you shouldn't be drinking more than every 3 miles.
Hmm. Well, what can you share with us, or if there's anything that we can glean from how much salt that we're carrying on our face or our arms or on our shirt? Does that mean anything to us, or should it?
It means a huge amount. Thank you for asking that. One of the great scientists in the United States was a chap called Jerome Kahn, and in 1941, after the Pearl Harbor disaster, the U.S. military came to him and they said, we know we're going to be fighting the Second World War, in the Pacific Islands. We know it's hot. We know our guys are not, many of them don't come from the hot parts of the United States. How are we going to cope with the heat of the battle? They said, you've got to find out what we can do to pre-acclimatize. And he was given the right to work with some religious objectors. And these guys are totally committed to helping the U.S. government and the U.S. Army. And they would exercise for 6 hours a day. And he would stick them in a heat chamber and make them exercise for 6 hours a day, 7 days a week. Now, no one will do that today, I don't think. But because they had the feeling they would had to help the war effort, they were prepared to do it. And what he did with them was he put them through heat acclimatization. So every day they would do their 6 hours of exercise. And then he decided, I'm going to change how much sodium they take. So he started giving them about 20 grams of sodium a day. Then he cut it to 10 grams. Then he cut it to 5 grams. And eventually cut it to 2 grams. So these are guys who are sweating vigorously, exercising very hard, and for 6 hours a day in these chambers. And he found the remarkable thing that their excretion of sodium in their sweat and their urine was entirely dependent and absolutely matched how much he gave them. So if he gave them 20 grams a day, they excreted 20 grams a day in their urine and their sweat. If he gave them 2 grams a day, they excreted exactly 2 grams a day in their urine and their sweat. And then because he was a genius, he said, aha, there must be a hormone regulating this. And he predicted that a hormone called aldosterone would be discovered. And it was discovered, in fact, after the war, which was a hormone we didn't know anything about, but he predicted it from his studies. But the key point was that he proved that your output of sodium is determined by the input. So if you are outputting a lot of sodium, and so you're showing a lot of sodium on your face, that's because your intake is so high. Now, what the industry did, they were so clever because they said, aha, if you've got salt on your face or in your running shorts, you're a salty sweater, you need to drink more salt. You must drink our salt-containing sports drink. That is completely wrong. The more salt you take, the more salt will appear in your sweat. What you want is a sweat that has got no taste to it. Then you know you're in some perfect salt balance because you've got a low intake and your excretion is absolutely matched. So anytime you have salt in your sweat, you're eating too much salt. And you must cut back.
Do you feel that there is even need for salt capsules on the race course? Because I know as a runner, as many of us, you know, we put our shoes on, we fill up our water bottles, and then we put a pack of salt somewhere handy because we know that we're going to need it on this run. So do we even need salt?
We've been told we needed it.
Well, I'll take credit. We feel we need it. You're blaming somebody else, Scott.
Now, what we have to do is distinguish between two different facts. As far as sodium balance goes, you do not need to take that sodium because you will be excreting during the race the excess of the sodium you ingested the day before. And any extra sodium that you drink during the race will simply appear in your urine. We know that. So you don't actually need it to manage your sodium balance. But there is a component we know that the brain has a link to the tongue. And when you put salt on your tongue, the brain will recognize that salt is coming into the body. And it may well modify your performance. We certainly know that if you put food in your mouth, particularly carbohydrates, but I think protein and fat, but they haven't really been studied yet. So if you put carbohydrate in your mouth, your brain immediately interprets that this is good and allows you to run faster. We know that if you've got a cramp and you put a salty drink on your tongue, you will reduce the cramp. It will tend to break within about 40 seconds. So that can't be because the salt entered your intestine and been absorbed. It's because the salt is acting through a reflex into the brain, and the brain is for some reason responding to the salt and saying, okay, we mustn't have muscle cramping at this time. Because incidentally, muscle cramping is a brain spinal cord phenomenon. It's got nothing to do with the salt balance in your body. So my point is that salt, people may take salt and they may say, my gosh, it does improve my performance. And I would not discount that. But it's not acting by improving the self-balance. It's acting in the brain, and it's confusing the brain, but the brain is interpreting that salt is coming into the body, and that is good, and therefore you can run faster.
And the book has this in great detail, and you break it down, and if you need to hear or study it more as you're listening to this stuff, and I think anybody that's interested in enjoying the sport out there and getting the most out of the experience and out of your body, it's good to understand these mechanisms. It's all there, well written in that book. So another plug, I say go out and get that and learn more.
Well, thank you so much for that.
I have a question. We talked about cramping. So what causes cramping, and how, as we're running these multiple hour events, if we start having cramps, what is the best way to get rid of them and deal with them?
Good question.
This is a really exciting area. My colleague, Professor Martin Schrellnus, has been at the forefront of researching this. And he developed a theory already 20 years ago, probably, that there are reflexes in the muscle that prevent them from cramping. So generally, you've got to dampen down normal reflexes in the muscle. So in other words, there are reflexes arising from the spinal cord going back to the muscle, which would cause the muscle to go into cramp. And we have to have mechanisms to prevent that. And when we're at rest, those are highly effective, and they prevent us from going, our muscles from going into cramp. However, when we run, and particularly if we run slightly faster than we want to or we really should be running, it seems that that reflex gets, as it were, tired, and the inhibitory reflexes become less strong. And as a consequence, the excitatory impulses, which cause the muscle to go into cramp, become dominant. And as a consequence, the muscle goes into cramp. And we know that because if we look at the electrical activity in the muscles, we notice that before they cramp, the activity starts to rise. So something's changing in the muscle that is making more prone to go to cramp. And then you continue for a bit further and it goes into a full cramp. And the point is, it's an electrical phenomenon. It's a reflex that may originate in the brain and more likely originates in the spinal cord, but has almost certainly got nothing to do with dehydration and sodium balance. It's got everything to do with genetic predisposition, and also has got everything to do with how tired you are and how hard you've exercised.
That's very interesting, because if you think about the cramps that you've experienced, they are in a specific muscle that's innervated from some specific nerves. And that's the muscle that then decides to cramp radically, yet there aren't any other muscles around them or any other place in your body are completely normal and not relaxed. And if it was a sodium issue within the blood, you would have multiple cramps in multiple places, and it would take a very long time for them to resolve and not loosen up after this reflex has then relaxed. So I think that is interesting. What's the remedy? What do you do? What's the solution when you're out there?
Slow down. The cramps. Yeah, the cramp is a body way to say stop running. Yeah.
Yeah. The remedy, unfortunately, is to do lots of stretching of the muscle, lengthening the muscle. Because what we also find is that muscles that haven't been lengthened, i.e., muscles that are working in a small arc, and they're acting in a shortened position, those are the ones that go into cramp. So you need to stretch the muscle, lengthen it, to make it less susceptible to cramping. I might just add that yesterday I had lots of muscle massage, because the day before I ran really hard and hurt the fascia. And what we used to think of as muscle tears, and in my book Law of Running described as muscle tears, now we begin to think not. It's something to do with the fascia surrounding the muscle that becomes irritated, and that then causes the electrical activity in the muscles to go up, and they start to cramp, although you wouldn't notice it. If you feel them very carefully, you can see they're fasciculating, i.e. they are contracting inappropriately. And when you palpate them, you feel the muscles are partially in cramp. And when the physiotherapist or the physical therapist examines them and rubs them, they find these intense areas of knottedness, which in a sense is a cramp. but it's too localized for you to notice it. So I think what we're going to find also is that injury is a part of it. And if you've been training hard and the muscle fascia is slightly damaged in some way that we don't yet fully understand, go out and race, and after time, what happens is the muscles start to cramp a little bit. They're too small for you to notice. And then all of a sudden, the whole muscle goes into cramp. But as it resolves, you find that there are still these nodules that continue to be cramping. And in my view, that's likely to be injury rather than anything else. So although I've spoken of as a reflex, it may also be a protective reflex, which stops you from running and damaging your muscle anymore. And what is so remarkable is, so I had my physio 2 days ago and could barely run. But today I went out and ran, and I was completely pain-free, and it was as if I had nothing wrong. So there's something else going on in muscles that can occur very, very quickly, i.e. it can occur within half an hour in a race and go from you running very freely to being completely cramp-ridden. And that can then take days to recover. And it's clear that massage has got something to do with helping it resolve. And again, the massage has got nothing to do with adding sodium or water in your diet.
Very true. From the viewpoint, perhaps, from waterlogged and jumping over to, on this one topic from your Lore of Running, an additional book that you should be checking out on whatever source you're getting it from, is can we run ultra distances safely? Is it okay for our frame? Are we built for ultra distance? I'm going to keep asking this question a little bit further, because I was thinking, how would I answer this? And I'm not going to answer for you, but I'm thinking that probably the right distance is how we were designed, depending on how long it takes to chase down an antelope. And that's probably the right distance. And all of a sudden, we've come along with our cerebral cortex and have decided that 100 miles is a nice round number, and off we go.
Yeah, I think from 40 years of running, I would say that half marathons is about right, because you can still speed up at the end. And that, to me, is a key determinant. If you're speeding up at the end, that means to me that your body is still in good shape. When you run a race where you have to hang in for many hours and you're slowing down progressively, to me that means that that's further than you should really be running. Of course, this is easy to say in retrospect, but that's what I think. And the problem in running is it's carrying your body weight. So whereas in, for example, cycling or in triathlons, they're essentially much easier because you don't carry your weight all the time. So that's the problem in running, carrying your body weight. However, I would like to say that I think people, a 21K doesn't give you the same emotional rewards that running a 90-kilometer or 56-mile race does. And I think that going through that 2 or 3 or 4 hours of decision-making and discomfort, it really has a huge impact on your life and your self-belief and your pride in yourself, which you can't get in a half marathon. So I think in terms of biology, it's probably best to run half marathons. But in terms of psychology, you really need in your life to run a few of these ultra races. But I'm not sure that you want to run lots of them every year for 20 or 30 years. I think you need to scatter them through your life and focus on the shorter distances and occasionally go for the longer distances.
That's a great answer.
Oh, that's what I was looking for.
Hey, when we knew that we were going to be interviewing you, we talked to a good friend of ours and a very noted sports nutritionist here in the ultra running community here in the United States, Sunny Blende, and we actually asked her what she would like to ask you, and we actually covered most of it. But there was one question I think that is very that I would like to ask that she brought up. As a runner and you're running these events, you know how much water you should intake because you're going to be taking it in because you're thirsty. Right. In some of these longer events, we sometimes have pacers that can help us, especially the ones that you're running through the night and you need somebody to be for safety purposes. Is there something that a pacer could be looking out for to maybe identify whether you are not drinking enough? I know we can now recognize, a pacer can recognize if you're drinking too much by the swollen fingers and weight gain and stuff like that. But is there something that they could help with to recognize if you're not drinking enough?
You know, that's a great question, because I don't know what happens to thirst at night when you're running at night. And it could be different than during the day. It could be either exaggerated or under-exaggerated. I suspect as you get tired, you probably drink less than your thirst really requires. I would just say that they need to ask, you know, are you thirsty? And if they are, we know that, you know, most people running at night in an ultramarathon probably losing 400 ml per hour. What's that? It's about a third of, it's about 12 ounces, I suspect, somewhere around there, maybe 15 ounces an hour. And if you're drinking that amount, you can't run into trouble at all. It's only when you're drinking 40 ounces an hour that you're going to run into trouble. So if you're drinking half that amount, you absolutely can't run into trouble. You can't be overhydrated, and you won't be dehydrated over that volume. So I would think that provided you're drinking your 10 or 15 ounces an hour at night, and that the person is helping you made sure you were drinking that amount, you'd be fine. And they should, as we've indicated, be wary that you're not drinking your 40 ounces now, which would be a disaster.
I appreciate this discussion, and reminds me just how much we just need to learn to listen to our body and listen to it on the trail, whether it's pace, whether it's effort, whether now it's fluid, which I thought I had handled. I thought just all I had to do is drink as much as humanly possible. And so that
or pre-drink.
Pre-drink. Yeah. Drink, loading up 2 days before for that race. And so this is something that is giving me new perspective, and I'm going to run every run different now.
It's going to be fun to go experiment now, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I'll be thinking of you a lot, Dr. Noakes, too, believe it or not. And it makes me think a little bit about these industries. You know, this story about fluid sounds very, very familiar with the shoes, doesn't it?
Yes.
So they come along and the shoe companies sell us on large soles, that big cushion, and say, now go out and run. And we change our gait and we start doing things differently, and injuries go up, and shin splints and knee pain and all kinds of things, because we've gone away from that natural running style. And similar thing with fluid now. Don't listen to your body, listen to us. And drink. And if it wasn't for this discussion and your book, particularly your studies, and in part of the intro, I missed saying over 250 published in peer-reviewed journals studied, amazing amount of work that's been done, not necessarily on this subject, but within exercise physiology. It's nice to have an authority come on and remind us and tell us that listen to your body and make it simple. And the science is behind it if you're really interested in understanding why. But to start with, just listen to this great internal program and internal voice that's been given to you, and go out and enjoy it and be sensitive to what your body's trying to tell you, and quit overloading it with messages from the marketing machine. So, Dr.
Indeed, and I would extend that now to what you eat, because that we haven't discussed that. And what I notice now, we've got a lot of people who've moved away from high carbohydrate diets and who are eating just fat and protein in training and very low carbohydrate diets. And what they discover and what they tell me is that they observe that during races, people do exactly what they do during their normal daily living. And those who are carbohydrate addicted or eat lots of carbohydrate during their training do exactly the same. And after an hour's running, they're already looking for the first carbohydrate binge to correct the brains telling them, go and find carbohydrate. Whereas if you've adapted to eat fat and protein, these people can go for 4 or 6 hours without needing to eat. And they will exercise with just drinking water. And which is completely contrary to what I wrote in Law of Running. It's the absolute opposite. And again, the question I would ask is exactly what you've asked. When we were hunting 2 million years ago, did we have candy sticks every half hour to eat? And the answer is no. We ran, we caught the animal, I drank its blood, we drank its water, and we ate the liver, and then we headed home. And that's how we did it. So we didn't eat during those 4 hours that we 4 to 6 hours that we were chasing the antelope. And I suspect in time we'll discover that you don't need to eat in these races. You only need to eat as if it was what you would normally do. So if you're running a 12-hour race and you eat a big meal every 12 hours, then you need a big meal during that 12-hour race somewhere along the way. But if you don't normally eat more than every 6 hours, why would you need to eat every 6 hours when you're exercising? Because the answer is your body has more than enough fat to provide all the fuel for running that 6 hours in an ultramarathon. The fact that you're taking the carbohydrate is you're actually responding to an addiction which you have generated during your day-to-day living, and that's the way you're eating. And industries come along and said, well, that's a good addiction to have. Why not continue it while you're exercising and take all this carbohydrate?
And it tastes good too.
Yeah, of course, and it gives you that boost and so on. So I think that the next issue we'll be discussing is how much carbohydrate do I really need to eat during these ultramarathon races?
I feel like this has been an intervention. I feel like I was educated and corrected in my many habits and selection of food and drink.
I hope people that are listening to this podcast while they were running have a full water bottle right now.
A full water bottle and a couple of goos in their pack that they just will not open. Pennies on the dollar now for goos. Dr. Noakes, thank you so much for educating us and delivering your important message and changing the way we run and will approach running, at least for me, I'm certain.
We're in your debt.
No, well, thank you so much. It's a great privilege to be able to speak to you, to answer such intelligent questions and have this wonderful debate, and to put these ideas out there for the runners that they can question themselves and ask the questions. Because what's happened is so much of running is a dogma. The science is a dogma, and we can't allow it to happen. We don't know the full answers. And what I've said tonight, not all of it's true, but only by questioning and questioning can we advance the science. And then that's what my goal has been tonight, is to get runners to ask the questions, and thank you for asking those questions so well.
Well, Dr. Tim Noakes, thank you so much. Coming to us from Cape Town, South Africa, thank you for joining us. Nation members, thank you for joining us. Go visit the website at trailrunnernation.com. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter if you'd like. Dr. Tim Noakes is an active tweeter, we have found out, and you can probably see some of his information on Twitter.
@Prof Tim Noakes.
So thank you very much, and go out and run.
Mas.
Old Ann and I, with throats burned dry and soul that cry for water. The nights are cool and I'm a fool. Each star's a pool of water. Cool, clear water. And with the dawn I'll wake and yawn and sway and seem to say, tonight we pray.